Okay, yeah. So today we're all very happy that our own Niyayish of Shorty will be speaking to us. So he doesn't need any introduction for this audience. All of us know him super well. So this year he's been doing some very interesting work on the COVID pandemic, trying to understand what's happening. And so today he's agreed to tell us all about it. And so Niyayish, whenever you're ready, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you very much, Neil, for the introduction. Thank you guys for joining in. So I just want to make sure that others in the, can they hear me?
I mean, I
Yep.
hear you.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good, wonderful. Okay, well, welcome everybody. Thank you very much for joining in. And yeah, so I hope, so this is something, if you've heard me talk before, this is obviously something very different from everything you've heard from me in the past. And I'm going to tell you today why I think this is an important thing to talk about. I guess probably you won't be very surprised, and why we are might be the right people to actually be working on this. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about how to manage the COVID-19 pandemic, or possibly pandemics in general across geography and demography. Okay. Oh, now let's see. So just before we get started, these are my collaborators. So Ben Holder, who's a professor at Grand Valley State University. He's a virologist, or I guess he has a physics background, but has been doing virology. His plan was to visit me on sabbatical and work on general relativity and gravitational waves, but somehow things took a turn when he arrived here. And then we had two other unusual collaborators, Mats Bahrami and Danny Litzblah, who are in fact engineers at Wolfram Research, scientists and engineers at Wolfram Research, who build Mathematica. Many of you are familiar with. So before I get started, I just want to let you know that you could explore further about forecasts and cloud simulations for every US county. This is the link that you're gonna see flashing later in the talk as well. There will be up-to-date resources, open data, immunity maps, hopefully data for other countries whenever we get around to it. And our first analysis paper can be found both on archive and medRxiv. I'm not sure how many papers actually appear on both of them, but there you can find it, whichever is your favorite preprint repository. If you go to any of these, you're likely going to end up here, where you could, if you do live in the US or you are interested in what's happening in the US, you could actually type in the name of your favorite county and basically write down when you think you're interested in forecasting, what time frame, when you want to start a forecast. It could start from there sometime in the past, or it could start from now, forecasting into the future. And I think the most importantly, you could actually describe the kind of mitigation or quantify the type of mitigation that that county uses. Of course, we use historical data, but for whatever happens into the future, you could use whatever you choose, and for example, choose a face mask. And then you can run a simulation, and it tells you what the model says is going to happen. And this is the default is Boston that you see here, and tells you the information, which is as of July the 16th, and basically various properties that I'm going to talk about that we argue are important in terms of predicting what's going to happen in every community across the world. So Canada is going to be next. Of course, that's where I live, and many of you guys, but not all. But as it turns out, there's much more data in the US, so doing this analysis for the US is much easier, unfortunately, in terms of mortality, but also in terms of other types of data that we want to use to make this type of analysis. Please don't hesitate, by the way, to interrupt, and as I know you do in these PI talks, or you could, I guess, use the chat room. I think Neil would probably keep an eye on this. I'm not sure, Neil, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Good. So, by the way, from this plot, for example, and we have, when if you run this for every county, you're going to get a bunch of plots. One of these is this kind of the actual data for Boston, and these are our forecasts. Now, I think most of you know me, but just a reminder, most of the time that you hear me talk, you don't hear me talking about pandemics, you hear me talk about the Big Bang, about how quanta gravitates, about how we can see the dark universe, and what lies at the bottom of the black holes, gravitational waves, echoes, dark matter, dark energy, cosmological constant. However, and now this thing happened again. Let me just see my, I think my mouse sometimes disappears. But then this happened. So as you all know, in late December, there was a pneumonia of unknown origin, first noticed in Wuhan. Cases were appeared to cluster around the seafood market. This was closed in 1st of January and 12th of January, novel human coronavirus was sequenced. It was identified or it was named as SARS-CoV-2 and the disease named as COVID-19. And these are similar to bat coronaviruses that have been identified in the past and passed through to humans through intermediate animals. Now, I mean, we all lived through this, so there is really no need for introduction, at least at this point. We know that this was the mortality or daily mortality, which first was in China, and it was in the hundreds per day. And then it spread across the world. The second peak was everywhere, basically in Europe and North America. And the mortality was in tens of thousands across the world, and or a border 10,000, I should say. And on March 11th, the pandemic was declared. Now, this pandemic is devastated and has devastated many countries across the world, some more than others. So this is a plot that you're going to see again, and not for different countries, but this is kind of one representation of how a pandemic has devastated different countries. So what this is the type of phase portrait, which shows the daily mortality, although it's a 7-day roll average of daily mortality as a function of total mortality associated to COVID. And you see that different countries are in different places in this phase diagram. And as it turns out, the biggest large country in terms of mortality per population is Belgium, that has the biggest peak and biggest mortality per population. And behind that is United Kingdom. And I mean, you can see there are other countries that occupy here. I'm just showing United States, Canada. And you see some countries are just getting started, are just down here, and other countries appear that they might be reaching the end of pandemic, but maybe there are second peaks. So these are the things that we have to identify.
And sorry, if I can ask a question. End of pandemic is an interesting question and it implies that something physical has happened. I think you're going to talk
that,
about
that
this.
I absolutely agree with you. And yeah. It's good to hear you, Michael, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes, we don't know that they are at the end of pandemic. And indeed, yeah. There could be second waves. And in fact, I don't have some of these plots, but like if you look at Israel, mm-hmm. It actually goes down and then comes back up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about actually, in fact, one of the goals of this talk is to identify which countries or which communities may have second peaks and which communities shouldn't have a second peak, mm-hmm. according to basically a physical analysis of the data we have. Wonderful. So let's now talk about these questions. And in fact, Michael brought up one of them already. So what factors drive epidemic growth and decay? So in some countries it grows, in some countries it decays. What's responsible for that? Now, the key analysis that I'm going to present here to you is whether US county differences in demographic settlement weather or other properties can allow these factors to be identified. Another important point, which I'm going to come up again and again, is that correlation is not causation. So just because you find correlation, and that's a common mistake and common practice, especially these days, that you look at correlations and you think there's some causal relationship. In order to actually infer causation, one needs a causal model or a mechanistic model for the disease. At least as a physicist, this is what we are used to. And that's what I'm going to do here. The important question, which is basically the question that was related to what Michael Strauss brought up, was, has herd immunity been reached anywhere across the world? And maybe the most pressing question for all of us as citizens is, what are the best steps to manage or avoid future outbreaks in every community? And this may be, and in fact, we'll see, will be a community-specific answer. But there will be a community-specific answer. A simpler way to put this question, that is this last question, is these are two places, two islands in the US, the Kodiak Island in Alaska and then Manhattan Island in New York. Do both these places have to go into lockdown when a pandemic hits? So that's the question that I hope to be able to answer or convince you of the answer by the end of this talk. So this is, with that introduction, and again, don't hesitate to interrupt me. This is the outline. I'm going to describe the data that we're going to use. I'm going to talk about linear models to fit the data. Then I'm going to talk about nonlinear or physical models to fit the data. This is what I call mechanistic or causal models. Then I'm going to talk about possibly the most sticky issue related to this epidemic, which is the issue of herd immunity. And then I'm going to leave you with some final thoughts and open discussions, which, well, depending on how much time we have or you have, it's going to take probably a while. So let's just start with the data. So these are the data that we use. So we use a bunch of static data sets. So we use demographic data from US Census for every single US county. In fact, the starting point for our analysis 4 months ago was what is not very well known, but what is known in the census community as the population-weighted population density, or some people call it lived density, what I call PWD here, population-weighted density. And this is something that you can now infer for every county or every geographic region using these GSS pop raster images that is available from European Union. So this is basically a map of human density across the world using compiled using different methods with a resolution of 250 meters. So I'm going to tell you what the definition of this is. And another measure that I'm going to use is population sparsity, which is a measure of distribution of people in every county. So this is the kind of map that you're dealing with, this GHS pop map, or GHS population map. So this is the Boston area that, in fact, I showed you the data for before. And in the middle, you see this is the Boston, and then there's kind of the greater Boston area. You see the green and blue is where the population and density is the highest. And as you go farther away, the population density drops. These are the boundaries show the counties, the political boundaries of the different counties. But of course, as you see, that the population density is very inhomogeneous. And what people are used to, if you say, enter in Google, what is the population density of, say, Suffolk County? So you cannot see my mouse, is that right? Or can you?
I am not seeing it, actually.
You're not seeing this. Yeah, okay. So let me just see whether I can stop. Sorry. Can you see my mouse now?
Yeah, now I see it.
Okay. So let's just try again. Yeah. How about now?
No, it's gone away.
Okay, so yeah, so there used to be something at a pointer or something on Zoom, but now I don't find it. Let's just go without the mask because I cannot actually find any pointer option now in my menu. So I'm just going to describe things to you. Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
So this is the Boston area, and as I said, the population is very inhomogeneous. So if you enter the population density of a county, say Suffolk County, in Google, then it's going to tell you basically population divided by geometric area. But as you can see, that's kind of meaningless for some of these because like a lot of places is like the sea where nobody lives. So that area doesn't really mean anything, or that population density. What's more important is the lived density that I'm going to talk about in a a little bit more. So in addition to this population of statistics, we use dynamical data. So the dynamical data includes, of course, the COVID-19 daily mortality and case incidence, and that's available from both Johns Hopkins University and from New York Times. And we use both of those data sets. We use weather information from NOAO, which includes temperature, a specific or absolute humidity. And we use human mobility information in workplaces, homes and transits, stations from Google. That's becoming basically periodically Google makes this data available for some US counties. Okay, so what is population weighted density? So the average density, as I said, is given in the maps of a resolution of 250 meter. So what you can define is average density of these 250 meter squared parcels within a county, but you weight each parcel by the population in each that parcel. So the weight the density by the population of that parcel. So that means that these two counties on the left and right, they even though the one on the right has a smaller density because it's the same number of people who live there, but it's a larger area, they have the same population weighted density because in all these empty places where the density is zero, there's nobody lives, obviously, so they have zero weights. So that's so this is an example of how population weighted density tells you, in fact, what is the population that any person sees living around in their neighborhood, as opposed to in the greater county, say that there could be deserts and seas that don't really matter. And that's presumably what matters. The actual density of people who live around you is what probably matters for the propagation of the disease. At least we're gonna see that would be the case. So another measure that we use is population sparsity. And those of you who do cosmology, you would recognize this. This is something that, in fact, Jim Peebles, who won the Nobel Prize, measured 30 years ago for the galaxies. Well, if it works for the galaxies, we thought maybe we could just do it for people as well. So what we did was that basically we looked at this population weighted density as a function of the parcel area. So if you like, you can look at bigger and bigger parcels. Of course, this population weighted density becomes smaller and smaller. And we basically fit the power law to it by comparing basically the entire county, largest if possible parcel, and the smallest possible parcel, which is 250 meters squared. So these are the two examples. The county on the left, it has gamma of zero because basically if you make the pixels or parcels bigger, the density is the same. But the county on the right has a population sparsity on 1/3 because basically if you look at bigger areas, the density becomes smaller. And the reason this you would think it matters for an epidemic is that if you look at the county on the left, every parcel has three different parcels that they can pass on the disease to. But the county on the right, every parcel has one or two different counties that they can, or different parcels that they can pass on the disease to. Because of that, you would think that then the parcel on the right, or the county on the right, which is a sparser population, the disease has a harder time being transmitted and propagating or spreading. And that's what must be something that should affect how an epidemic spreads in a community. Okay, and of course we're gonna see whether that works, that's the case or not.
So should we think of this gamma as like, you know, is it something like the slope of the power spectrum of the density?
That's right, absolutely. It will be the slope of the correlation function, right? So this, in fact, this PWD is like sigma squared, and this, I guess, area would be like the mass, right? So have your sigma squared scales with the mass. Of course, this is two-dimensional, but otherwise, this is the same thing. So if you have a power law, power spectrum, it would be a constant. Now, of course, this is not exactly a constant, but for the purpose of our analysis, we're just going to deal with one number because that's two numbers more than everybody else has used so far. So we basically have a normalization and we have a power. So the normalization is what I introduced here on 250 meters squared, and then the power is this gamma.
Sorry, okay. Naish, quick question.
Go ahead, Neil.
I would have thought if it's linear in dimension, it would be gamma would be a half, not a third.
Yeah, if I think that would be true, and in fact, I originally wrote like half, but I mean, this is not exactly linear because these quantities are not thin, very thin. So okay. If you actually compute it for this geometry, it's one third. But indeed, you're right. In the linear, if you have a linear distribution, it would be a half, and if you have just one point, it would be one.
Okay, so the realistic, you're using the data here to get the one
that's
third.
That's right. I mean, the mock data that I have here,
great.
I'm using
okay.
that. That's
thanks.
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Yes, indeed. In fact, you can think of this gamma as the measure of the dimension of distribution. And gamma of zero would be a two-dimensional distribution. Gamma of one would be a zero-dimensional distribution. But yeah, so this is just a number for now. So these are the examples of other data that we use. So in the top row, now this is kind of the data that's, I think probably we haven't seen anything like this until in the history of probably history of humanity until this pandemic hit. And this is the mobility, the top row is the mobility that has been reported by Google for different metropolitan areas. And in fact, Google does report it for every county. So here we have collected different metropolitan areas for one of our analyses.
Are you going to define mobility for us?
Sure, absolutely, yes. So what Google did was, in fact, so of course, as you all know, that Google knows where you are and what you do all the time, as the, I guess, other cell phone companies as well. So what they do is that they actually have a measure of how many people show up in different places. And they have a list of, I think, 6 and 7 different types of places. There are residential areas, there are transit stations, there are workplaces, there are grocery stores, things like that. So they actually looked at 5 weeks in January, right before all these things started happening, at least in the US, and then compared all the subsequent days to the average of those 5 weeks in January, and then reported the relative number of people who showed up in these different places compared to basically those 5 weeks in January. So you notice that, and these are starting from the 29th of February. This is the zero is 29th of February here. And this would be, I guess, 20th of February. That would be the number minus 10. So you see this as basically you have the baseline, which is zero. And then suddenly as the pandemic is declared, every people, there are all these lockdown orders that come into effect. But even before that, people are starting to worry. They're based kind of voluntary stay at homes. So you see that mobility starts to decrease. And this one, what I've showed here is an average of transit stations, workplaces, and and I guess there was a third thing which I forgot. Okay, so it's transit stations, workplaces, and one more thing. I think it's retailer stores, basically, yeah. So this is what's shown here. And they're kind of all follow each other, but this one is averaging those three. So you see basically that the number of people who went to work in New York City basically at the end of March was 75% less than it was in January. And Los Angeles, it was more like 50% smaller. And Grand Rapids, Michigan, it was also comparable, around 50% smaller. And then they slowly started rising again. And you see these lines for some places were faster than others. So that's the first, the mobility data. And this is amazing because we never had this type of data before because never in the past, so many people carried cell phone and they all kind of all their presence have been logged in this manner. So we can learn something basically new about pandemics that was never possible before. Then we had case incidences. So this for first analysis here, we use case incidences, which is how many cases were detected. But here we're trying to kind of model the initial exponential growth. And this lambda is exponential growth rate, which is the slope of this line that you see early on. And then we assume it becomes flat, which of course is not true everywhere. Like for New York City, it starts coming down. So it's not a very good fit for late times, but this actually gives us, you see that the slope that you see here gives us the exponential growth in the early phase. And the bottom panel shows temperature and humidity that we use, and that of course doesn't have a very huge jump, but as you see, the gradually things warm up during the winter as they should.
And the case incidence is based on hospitalizations, correct?
This is just detection.
Yeah, okay, so it does depend on how thorough the testing is.
That's right. So indeed, this is the problem with anything that you do with the cases. And I mean, as we see, everything that we do has its own biases, but this particular analysis is just based on the cases that were reported by the county. And I'm gonna tell you about other measures we use. And interestingly, they seem to give you the same result. Okay, so this is the data. So the next step is to try to understand this data in terms of models. And here, the first thing, we study linear correlation. So we just basically do regression. So for the first analysis, we just kind of did the simplest possible thing. We basically used our data are predictable as the growth rate, lambda, that I showed you. So this parameter, lambda, that you see at the middle panel. And we try to basically fit it to all possible demographic and mobility information that we have available. And we looked at basically like dozen or so different things. And it turns out that there are five of them that are most significant. They're basically more than three sigma, really, that we're going to see. So the most significant is, in fact, the mobility, and it's not very surprising. Places where the mobility drops, the pandemic basically slows down. And here, this is mobility 2 weeks prior to this phase. So there's a way that we have to measure mobility is basically 2 weeks prior to this end. So that's like an 11 sigma correlation. So places that the mobility drops more, the growth rate is slower. Places that mobility doesn't drop, then they grow more quickly. The next big correlation is almost 5 sigma, and that's this population weighted density. In fact, it's the logarithm of population weighted density. So in fact, this is the first time that anybody has done anything with the logarithm of population weighted density, as far as I know. And it turns out it's also positively correlated. The more densely weighted places, the more densely populated places, the pandemic grows faster. And in fact, that would be New York City, which has the highest population density across North America. And in fact, here we are kind of showing in this table the weight of different factors, and you see that the reddest kind of the darkest red column that you, the entry you see here is from New York City, and the reason it's so red is that basically we think the reason New York City grows so fast according to this fit is because it has the biggest population weighted density. It has the fastest growth compared to anywhere else in the US. So the lambda, the exponential growth rate, was 0.34. And other factors that are less important, but nevertheless are still important, there is a specific humidity that's negatively correlated. So it seems that places that humidity is larger, this epidemic grows more slowly. The sparsity is also important. The sparser the population, the slower the epidemic grows, and that grows, and that also makes sense because if you have a sparse population, it's hard for the virus to get around. If you have a uniform population, then virus can get around easily. And here you see a weak dependence on median age, but I'm going to show you that in the other analysis, it's going to be a stronger dependence. It's around 2 sigma for the median age. So any questions about this?
So this column, so this coefficient column,
yeah.
Does that mean just like the cross-correlation coefficient between that quantity and the growth rate? Is that what that means?
So this is actually the number. So if you basically do a linear fit, write lambda as a linear combination of these factors, these are the coefficient in front of that quantity. So for example, if you look at say this population weighted density, so if there's a county which is exponential of one, basically E times denser than another county, but everything else is the same, then that means that the lambda is bigger by 0.05 roughly in that county. So it's just basically the coefficients in the linear fit, right? Okay.
Okay, like, but these numbers are all small compared to one, so I'm just wondering, you know, what that means. Like,
yeah, so the numbers are all, because lambda is, so the numbers that we're talking about, so we're just fitting lambda, so it's not a dimensionless quantity. Right. So we're fitting this value of lambda, and the value is 0.3, of order 0.3, basically, between 0.1 and 0.3, which is this exponential growth rate.
Niyesh, is that in days?
It's per day, that's right. They're all per day.
Thanks.
So no problem. So that means that if it's one, that means that within one day, the number of incidences increases by e to the one, basically. And the biggest one is for New York City, which is around 0.4. So it's basically within 3 days, roughly, or just less than 3 days, the number of cases increased by a factor of e, by an e-fold. And yeah, so you see the biggest factor is the constant. So in fact, there is something that appears more or less universal about this. And we're going to see, in fact, what it is that has to do with the incubation time of the disease. So the constant, in fact, is the biggest contributor, which is the same everywhere. But then all these other factors also can increase or decrease how fast the disease grows. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so let me then show you our second analysis. So this time we decided we kind of go all out, and then instead of just early growth, let's fit everything. So basically not just early growth, but early, intermediate, and late time growth or decay of the disease. So the way we did it was basically we looked at this mortality data. So what you see on the top right. So here, these are the four countries that had the biggest mortality in the US. And this is the logarithmic scale in the vertical axis. And you could basically see that this lambda is the exponential growth rate, which is positive early on. And then of course it becomes zero. And then as the disease starts decaying, then it becomes negative. So we can basically fit a line to this in 14-day windows and see that if you look at every 14-day window as a data point for every county, so that gives us roughly 5,000 data points for across counties and times where you could actually measure this meaningfully. And to do this, by the way, we use mortality statistics because we think it's more reliable and it's kind of less dependent on the number of testing rates or testing rates and bottlenecks that exist in policies. But nevertheless, I mean, there could be issues with that, and we're going to come back to that as well. So we use mortality for this analysis, which is basically completely independent data from the previous one that I showed you. So previous one was case incidences, this is mortality. And we do a linear regression, and then later I'm going to talk about a nonlinear or a physical model. So the linear regression, the bottom, first look at the bottom plot. So this is the bottom plot shows the logarithmic derivative, which is these lambdas. You see they start big, like for New York City, it was around, in fact, it starts from 0.4. And then it drops at later times, as you can see, because basically you see that the growth slows down. And at some point when you reach a peak mortality, lambda goes through zero, and then it becomes negative. And most counties go through something similar, although some of them, it appears that lambda becomes zero and it stays around zero. It doesn't decay or doesn't become negative. Other ones like New York City, in fact, it does decay. So we're going to come back to this. So that's an interesting issue. Like Los Angeles, it seems that it kind of stays flat and it's kind of stayed flat like that. But New York City is in fact decaying. So we again looked at different correlations, and I don't really want you to go through this. We have a lot of things that we have studied. So all potential drivers that you could think about. And we identified basically eight drivers that have basically more than three sigma significance. So six of them were the same as what we had for the case analysis. And in fact, we get the same number. So this, if you look, compare these coefficients that I've listed here, what I called estimate, is the same as the coefficient that I had for the case analysis. Even though I'm fitting a very different type of data, and I am in fact fitting not just early time data, I'm fitting late time data as well. So every data, the 5,000 data points that I have available. Nevertheless, I get the same coefficients. But then I get two extra dependencies, which were very surprising. In fact, the biggest dependency you can see here is minus 10 sigma significance. And that depends on the death fraction of COVID in the community. And that's independent of the social mobility and population density and sparsity and humidity and everything else. So these are all independent dependencies. So you basically simultaneously fit to everything. And I'm quoting basically the results. So it seems that the independent of social mobility, or if you have countries with the same social mobility and population density and sparsity and everything, if one of them has a larger fraction of people who have died, it has a slower growth rate. And that's very surprising. But in fact, this has a straightforward interpretation from biology, which people call herd immunity, and we're gonna come back to that. The second dependence that was surprising, and I won't come back to, because I think we don't really have much else to say, is a dependence on, in fact, the total annual death in the county, which is kind of a funny thing, because like if you double the size of the county, but keep everything else the same, this number changes, but other numbers are the same. So I think this is something, if you are physicists amongst you understand this as the randomization group scale. And I think it probably has something to do with the fact that you're averaging over the size of the county, and the bigger the county, a different is that averaging or coarse-graining scale. So it's similar to the role of cutoff in effective field theories, I believe. And the fact that we have logarithmic dependence on it is actually kind of interesting. Okay, so, but now we established this, but the correlation is not causation. So this doesn't actually tell you what's happening. It just tells you that we found this correlation. What is the underlying cause? I think we need a more convincing argument for it. And I think that's, next I'm gonna talk about the physical model, but before I go there, are there any questions? Okay, so now I'm gonna talk about actually how physicists would model an epidemic. So we had to do something that made sense, physical and of course biological. But then we kind of thought we need something that actually makes sense, and it should be a good enough approximation for what's actually happening in human body, but also simple enough that we can solve it. So we're modeling, in fact, what we decided to model is this modeling the disease as a random walk process. So here what you're seeing is the x-axis is what I call C, which is the stages of the disease. And I treat it as a continuous parameter. So epidemiologists usually treat it as discrete parameter, like these compartments of the disease. However, we actually treat it as a continuous parameter. And the y-axis is the number of people, or the density of the people in a community. So the idea is that you start at the origin when exposure happened. If any person who is exposed starts from the origin, and then they would do a random walk. And this is a random walk in the space of the disease. So that's basically as the virus is incubating in an exposed person's body. But the idea is that this is not a linear relationship. And this is what's novel about this analysis. It turns out that the way COVID affects people is it appears to be very unpredictable. People feel good and feel bad and good and bad. And for some people, this lasts a long time. For others, they don't even experience any symptoms. So kind of the insight that I had at some point is that maybe this is really a random walk process rather than some linear process that most epidemiological models assume. So the idea is that then you have this random walk process, but of course people do recover, some people do recover. So there is some rate of exit from this random walk. So that the disease is doing this random walk with some constant rate you're exiting, but if you happen to cross this threshold of the blue region, the infectious region, then you can actually infect other people. If you don't cross it, or if you exit before you cross it, then you don't infect anybody. So you got exposed, but you never got infectious or contagious. And basically, this comes from a simple diffusion plus decay equation, what you see on the right, where basically this is a diffusion in the space of the disease. And you could actually solve all of this analytically using exponentials, which makes this simple. As I said, because it's stochastic, as opposed to, in fact, you can go back and forth, as opposed to all these other compartmental models in epidemiology, it has very different behavior. So,
May I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
To what extent are you imagining that this exit rate is the same for infectious? You know, only a fraction of people who are infectious get hospitalized, only a fraction of the hospitalized die.
That's
only
a fraction.
Is it the same D throughout?
So our goal here is to model the spread of the disease or the community transmission. So so we don't actually explicitly model hospitalization and death. Because basically there's a small fraction of people who get hospitalized and die. So we really just model exposed and infectious, although, I mean, the next step, we can add those, but nothing that I'm going to talk about here depends on those next steps.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, good. And the next step is, how do you transmit? So every person, if they get exposed, this is what happens inside their body. There's some stochastic around the walk. But then the next question is, how does that person expose other people or infect other people? So here I have a top-of-the-line simulation. The susceptibles are green, so people who are not infected. Exposed are people who are exposed are not infectious yet, so that's the blue. And red are infectious people. And you see there are different sizes. So I'm modeling it as a collisional process. Some people can be more infectious than other people. So I'm going to run the simulation. And I think what you should pay attention, there was this blue guy who, there was this green guy who turned blue. And I can run again. And on the bottom left, there was this green person who was susceptible. And then it crossed path with the red person. And now he's blue, that is exposed now. So of course, this is a cartoon. But in fact, this is physicists all recognize this as a Boltzmann equation or the collisional process. And basically, the calculation you're doing is that the incidence rate, what epidemiologists call incidence rate, which is basically new infections per time per area, is a susceptible density times the infected density times an interaction rate or infection rate, which is basically cross-section times relative velocity. And the key here is that this beta or this interaction infection rate depends on the stage of the disease. And for simplicity, we assume it's zero if C is less than one. So if you're exposed, but they aren't infectious yet, if C is less than one, then your beta is zero. But then if C is bigger than one, it's a constant. So basically, that means that your random walk must have taken you here to this boundary between the yellow and blue region for you to be able to infect others. Before that, if you don't get there, you're not infecting anybody. So that's the story. So now we have the disease progress in person. And in fact, this can all be written for an epidemiology person, can be written in terms of renewal equation that can show you if someone is interested in supplemental slides. So you know how the disease progresses, and you know how people can infect each other. So you can put this together and kind of save you the math. And you're going to get the formula, which is still some math. But basically, all you have to know from this is that you get the exponential growth rate, which is this lambda, in terms of these other things that we assume. So D is the exit rate, beta bar is the infection rate that I talked about, S bar is the susceptible density, basically density of people who are not infected or have never been infected. And tau is its diffusion time that we had for the random walk, and W is some nonlinear function that we don't have to know. But the important thing is that now we have a nonlinear relationship. We have a formula that you could put in the community properties in it, and it tells you how fast a disease would grow in that community. Or maybe it doesn't grow and it decays. So basically, if the susceptible density or infection rate is small, then this W is a small number. So lambda becomes negative, so the disease is decaying. But if this infection rate is high or susceptible density, the density of people is high, then this W function is big because it is a monotonic function. And then the disease would be growing. And basically the next exercise is that basically we have this formula and we fit it all to those 5,000 data points that we had and find what these things are, basically these numbers are. So we basically have this nonlinear model, and the way we do this is that we have basically three type of dependencies. On the right, let me just show you first. So we have 9 parameters. We fit all our data, the 5,000 data points with 9 parameters, which is the same as the linear model. It is a very predictive model. The reduced chi-squared is not perfect. It's 1.3. It could be better, but it is already, given that we are kind of working in the dark, and this is our first epidemiology paper, and reduced chi-squared is 1.3, probably it's not that bad. And you could see that the red lines here are the predictions or the best fits from the model. And we have 9 parameters for all the counties all the time. So we're not really switching from county to county or anything like that. And then the blue is the measurement for different counties. And you see basically the reasonable fits, although the blue, they have a spread, which means there are errors. So the measurements from counties are not perfect because of various reasons for fluctuations. So the parameters that we have are this tau, which is basically tells you how the incubation depends on the age in the county and what is the number. So there's a power, we had basically fitted with the power law. Although tau is not really incubation time, tau is this diffusion time, and I'm going to tell you at some point that how it's related to incubation time. There is this exit rate, which is surprisingly universal across the counties and across time. So there is basically a very precise measurement of how fast the disease decays, this exit rate, which is around 18 days. And it's the same everywhere. So all these, you see basically all these plateaus that you see, the minimum they get is this 1/18 days, basically.
And that in your fitting, D is set to be constant, or do you fit it separately and then discover that it's about the same everywhere?
Well, I can show you. Yeah, we kind of do the different splits. So we split it to like young counties and old counties and large population and small population counties. And then we see it's the same number basically in different places. But yeah, I mean, for every fit, we assume it's a constant, but then we look at different subsets of counties and we find the same numbers basically. Then there is this herd immunity parameter, which is also very significant. You could see it's almost 5 sigma, although these are nonlinear, so you shouldn't take sigma very literally here. So there is a dependence on the COVID death fraction. And let me actually come back to that in a minute. So this beta, which is the cross section, also depends on a bunch of parameters. Depends on the social mobility, depends on the humidity, depends on the population sparsity, and depends on the total annual death. So basically the interaction rate of people with each other depends on all these parameters that we talked about, which is basically describes the human population distribution. So the chi-squared I told you is good. And again, I think the most interesting thing or the most surprising thing that comes out of this is this dependence, which is very strong on the death fraction. So more explicitly, we assume that the susceptible population density is the population weighted density that I defined before times this exponential, which is decaying with the death fraction. So that means that the larger the fraction of people who die in the community of COVID, the smaller is the population of the susceptibles, and it actually falls down exponentially. And again, this doesn't have to be the case, but it turns out it gives you a very, very good fit. We tried it in different counties and tried different functions, and this just works perfectly everywhere. And you get the same number, no matter how you split up the counties. I'm gonna tell you actually what that means in a minute if I get to it. So you could then use these fits, this 9 parameter fit, to predict what happens in different places. So this is an example that, so these are 4 counties across and 4 corners of the US. and we use all the data up to mid-May to find our best fit parameters and then use it to predict what happens afterwards. This is up to mid-June, but we now have data up to mid-July in our dashboard. So you can actually do this exercise for yourself. Go to this dashboard that I have, wolfram@COVID-19, enter the properties of counties. There's something wrong with New York City. There's some bug that doesn't work for some reason, but others, everything else works. So we could just try everything else. In fact, even for New York City, you could look at things around New York City.
So what's happening in LA? Why is it going up?
Good. Excellent question. So now let's do something else. I can skip this, but basically this is a visual representation of what I was showing before, is that there's dependence on all these various things in the different counties. And the most important one is social mobility and population weighted density, but there's dependence on other things. So if you're interested, I can come back to this, but let me just actually go to issue of what's happening in LA indeed. So this brings us to the sticky issue of herd immunity, which is something that I think I hadn't noticed this before, but apparently there is one article per day nowadays, either in New York Times or in various media, Quantum Magazine, NPR, you name it. Everyone is talking about this issue. So let me tell you what it means, at least what epidemiologists mean. So classical herd immunity defined as if a large enough fraction of a population achieve immunity, either through infection or through vaccination to a disease, then the reproduction number of that disease falls below one. I didn't talk about the reproduction number, but that basically what most epidemiologists use is basically the number of people who are on average get infected by one infected person. If it falls below one, that means that the epidemic is decaying. But that's basically, for us, it's the same as lambda being equal to zero. So basically, if you have a lot of people who are immune due to vaccine or just due to natural infection, so the susceptible population is too low, so the disease cannot basically be transmitted in time to another person. So that's called herd immunity. However, you can actually go beyond this herd immunity threshold. You can get more people infected. This is known as overshoot, and I'm going to show you a picture of what that means. Now, estimates for COVID-19 herd immunity, that it ranges from 20%, and in fact now, I've even seen 10% now, to 70%. And it turns out, and this is kind of a recent development, that this depends on how heterogeneous you believe your population is. And we're gonna come back to this point if there's time. So in fact, this is very uncertain, and we don't know what fraction of the people should be immune for herd immunity to be reached.
So remind me, Niyash, like, so how does this threshold depend on, how does this depend on R naught?
Yeah, so it goes as 1 - 1/R0. And R naught is, I guess, estimated to be like something between 3 or 4 in early parts of the epidemic. So that's actually for a homogeneous population, but it turns out that, and that's what people have been referring to, that's where the 70% comes from, based on their estimates of R naught. But it turns out things can be more tricky, so you don't really know.
Question about the herd immunity threshold.
Yes.
Shouldn't that also depends on the characteristic of the community, the mobility, and all the other parameters?
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the topic of this talk is. Indeed, you're right, and this is kind of one of the fallacies of the caricature of herd immunity you find in most papers. It does depend on a lot of things, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. So, and then there's discussion about whether immunity lasts. There are two different types of immunity due to TCL and antibody, and is it permanent? So that's the very open and a sticky question. However, what we find is that basically a much more data-driven way or evidence-based way of addressing this question is just to look at the death fraction and see whether it slows down if there are more people who die. which does track the number of people who are infected. So if we can actually have an unbiased measure of people who are infected, that would be maybe another thing to look at. But right now, the death fraction is the best or most reliable thing we have. And this is what we find. So what we find is that basically in different communities, based on that fits that we have, if the death fraction exceeds somewhere between 0.1 to 0.2% of the population, then lambda becomes negative. Now, this does depend on a lot of things, right? For example, on the top left, you see some average US county. And in fact, if the social mobility is reduced, then this happens earlier. So that's not surprising. If people are stay at home, then the disease have a harder time getting around. And if the small number of people get infected, then the disease stops growing. So that's the blue curve. But the red curve, which is the best fit even at normal social mobility, you see that if you reach basically somewhere around 2,000 deaths per population, then at least for this plot, you see that the lambda crosses zero. Oh, sorry, it's not 2,000. Sorry, it's about 1,200 on the left. On the right hand, so you have the best fit prediction for New York City. And New York City, of course, has a much higher population density. So, and that's the main reason New York City has a much faster growth rate, as we discussed. So for New York City to reach herd immunity, you need to reach basically something around 1,900 deaths per population. But the number doesn't actually change very much for kind of most metropolitan areas. It's somewhere between 0.1% to 0.2%. So in the bottom, I'm showing what I call basically the face portrait of the epidemic or the deaths, in fact. And this is basically what comes from our best fit models. The herd immunity point is basically the fixed point here, that if you start from there, that means that the disease doesn't grow. But if you start earlier, then the disease does grow and reaches a maximum at the point of herd immunity and comes down. Now, of course, if you have reduced social mobility, then everything is shifted to a smaller values because effectively you're kind of removing part of the population. And in fact, you may think that one way to approach, if your herd immunity is the strategy, you still need to have social distancing. But to the extent that you see the blue curve, the solid blue curve on the left, that's in fact, it starts from zero and goes stops at herd immunity. And that's at 33% social mobility. So that's one way to think about this. Of course, I mean, death fraction is not really the right way to think about this. And having 0.1% of population die is a large number of mortality. And that's not really a goal for any community. Now, this is the overshoot that I was talking about. So New York City had an early and fast enough growth of the epidemic that in fact it overshot the herd immunity despite the social distancing measures. And now it's basically passed by around 50 or 70% roughly, it's past the herd immunity threshold. So the prediction of this model is that if New York City goes back to the normal social mobility, the epidemic doesn't grow. And these are predictions for these other counties. And in fact, I think Michael asked about Los Angeles. So some places they had very little mortality because they had early enough lockdown. So the epidemic really never grew and it just stopped. And those places, of course, the reason the epidemic is not growing is because of the lockdown. And as soon as you lift the lockdown, then the epidemic would start growing. And you see that like Seattle, which is King County, Washington, and Los Angeles seem to be in that state, that if you lift the lockdown slowly or rapidly right now, then you see that the epidemic is gonna grow and in fact it's gonna overshoot. The same is true for Miami, and you actually do see, I mean, they did lift their lockdown and then the disease is growing basically kind of out of control. And they could very well be overshooting herd immunity. On the other hand, Boston, you see on the top right, it seems that it is actually approaching herd immunity limit. So the Boston, basically, it seems that if they do lift the lockdowns and people go back to normal lives, then the epidemic shouldn't, at least the prediction of the model, the epidemic shouldn't grow. And I mean, these are all kind of very surprising, but I mean, you can actually make a map of where has reached herd immunity. And you could see basically there are two main centers. There's Northeast United States, There is Louisiana and Georgia, some counties in Louisiana and Georgia, including New Orleans, for example. And you see Navajo Nation and around Arizona, which is surprising because, I mean, the death fraction there is very small, but it's a very, very sparse and low density. So indeed, as someone pointed out, the herd immunity threshold could be much, much lower for a low population density region. So that's kind of the prediction for that region, that in fact, they have already reached their herd immunity, even though it's the mortality fraction is much, much smaller. So I'm already kind of over time. So this is kind of a distribution, and you see that places that with high enough mortality appear to have reached herd immunity. So Neil, do you think, what do you think I should do in terms of time?
How much more do you have?
I think I have like four or five more slides.
Okay. But yeah, well, go ahead. I mean, it's fine. Okay.
Yeah, sorry guys. I mean, I guess we all been in lockdown for 4 months, so I don't think like 3 or 4 minutes would make too much of a difference. okay, so yes, few regions are hard hit, particularly like New York City, Detroit, New Orleans, and the mortality is between 0.1 to 0.3%. And according to their model, which surprisingly nobody else has done, I mean, this correlation with the death fraction, according to our model, basically, there's a strong enough correlation with death fraction that says these regions are past herd immunity. And this number does vary depending on the community. But the vast majority of counties in the US, and that's something to keep in mind, do remain susceptible. That means that the epidemic does grow. And if you just let things go, you're going to even overshoot herd immunity. So if you just take the herd immunity threshold, the mortality would be somewhere around 450,000 in the United States. But of course, if you just lift the lockdowns, you're going to overshoot it. So that could be even much more devastating. And there is, in fact, a prediction. I mean, is this real? Should you believe it? So there's a prediction for New Orleans, which, according to our model, it has reached herd immunity. So what if a county reaches herd immunity, but its neighbors have not? And in fact, you can see in the US South, cases are steadily rising, and it seems to be basically a second wave that's happening in the South. And as I said, most of the South is overwhelmingly susceptible, so that is consistent with our model. The question is that, will there be a spillover to counties that have reached herd immunity? And the prediction is that the mortality will plateau. It cannot grow because there is no community transmission. So you can have people who are infected who come into the community, but they are a small fraction of the people. So that they cannot basically trigger instability, because instability or this outbreak is something that's inherent to the community. You can see the test cases rising due to increased testing. And that's, I think, is kind of well documented. But the mortality shouldn't grow, and that's our prediction. So it could plateau because of spillovers, but it shouldn't grow. Now, if it does start growing, and in fact, New Orleans is a perfect case study, if it does grow, that then suggests that the immunity doesn't last. And of course, that would be unfortunate, but that could be a reality. So far, I think as far as we can tell, the model works, it looks like the immunity is holding up. But we see, and I mean, if you look at New Orleans data, we haven't seen any rise in it yet, even though the cases have been rising basically for almost 2 months now. So I think, I'm just kind of wrapping up, but I just want to say that the reason we have actually an understanding of what's responsible for this exponential dependence. And we think it's basically it has to do with the heterogeneity, that there is a population of super spreaders and the vulnerable population who die, who contribute to the mortality. And we think basically what we're measuring is the ratio of infection fatality ratio or rate, and this ratio of infection rate or mobility of super spreaders and vulnerables. And I think I misspelled vulnerable, sorry. So basically what we think is happening is that even though most people are susceptible, the super spreaders are the people who are driving the epidemic. And those are the ones who become infected the first and reach immunity first. And when they become immune, then the epidemic stops, even though most people don't have it, haven't gotten the disease. So we think that's what's happening, and I think that's that you can get the exponential decay from that, and you can fit basically all the data from that. But that requires the super spreaders to be basically 30 to 100 times more mobile than the average population, basically.
Or can I ask a quick question about that?
Yes, go ahead.
Does that mean if we, like, say, reduce lockdown procedures, or people get less cautious collectively, that, I guess, that would change the herd immunity threshold for that area, correct?
Yeah, but it's actually this ratio that matters. And it's an interesting thing that if everybody kind of stays home with the same ratio, the super spreaders and vulnerable people, then that doesn't change this. So I think what you want to do, and this is what I say, is that you want super spreaders to infect each other as much as possible, but vulnerable people to just be completely isolated. But of course, who super spreaders are is not exactly clear, but that would be in some sense the ideal strategy, that all the people who could be hurt by the disease, you will need to lock them away, but all the people who can just effectively spread the disease without getting hurt, you just want them to keep infecting each other. And that would be the strategy. I don't know how to implement that, but I mean, that would be the way to actually change this death fraction. The problem is that if you just lock down everybody, then just the disease stops there. And then as soon as you lift the lockdown, then you just go back up, you get a second wave. And that's what happened in many places, like in Israel is having that. Okay, so I'm wrapping up. So how to manage a pandemic? So I promise that I'm going to give you a strategy. Unfortunately, it's not going to be a very clear-cut one. But I'm just going to give you, I have some slides about incubation probability. If you want me, I can come back to this, but in the interest of time, I will just skip them for now. So basically, I think the most important question is how should we manage a pandemic? And I'd like to advocate for a scientific approach to this, which is the most importantly is find out what actually drives an epidemic in your community. And it would be different in different communities, could be very different in different communities. It could be dependent on population density, in age, in social mobility, in weather, and herd immunity. And the problem is that up until now, nobody actually knew these dependencies. And I mean, I think we are the kind of the first to quantify all of these at the same time. So we should then find out the human cost of mitigation, like lockdowns, the school closures, and face masks, and then identify potential endpoints and their likelihoods, like either developing a vaccine or herd immunity. And then basically, another question, which I don't have an answer to, is that can you effectively separate super spreaders from vulnerable population? Because that's really the best way to minimize the cost of the epidemic. But then given these four pieces of information to the best of your ability, then you should optimize your strategy according to your evidence. And we have this dashboard that could help you with this. We don't have the answer to all questions, but at least questions that related to the epidemic, we have some answers about that. In terms of the cost of lockdown and school closures, we don't have the answer, but I'm sure others can work on this. So if you have answered these four questions, then you can design a strategy for your community, and it could be very different from community to other community. So for example, I showed you Kodiak Island and Manhattan, and it turns out that Kodiak Island doesn't need a lockdown. The epidemic never grows in Kodiak Island because it has a very low population density. Manhattan, of course, does, and Manhattan does need a severe lockdown, at least early on. But so at the end, I guess the takeaway message is, I mean, there are many of you are physicists, and I think I'd like to advocate for a physical approach to epidemiology, which is different from, I think the models that they have, they're either too simple or too complicated. And it's hard to make predictions using them. We've demonstrated that we have a predictive model that captures the main features of the disease and epidemic, we think. We think herd immunity happens does happen, and it happens through depletion of susceptible super spreaders. And in fact, there seems to be some growing consensus in this. There are several papers that appeared in the past months that suggest this based on theoretical analysis in basically if you have different types of population. The question, I think, as far as managing the pandemic is, can you somehow identify these super spreaders and separate them from the rest of the population? And if you can vaccinate them or somehow they could infect each other if we know that it's a safe infection. But of course, that's a big question and we don't really know the answer to that. Now, counties are not islands. Our analysis looked at county by county, but we haven't included the coupling. Can we mandate mobile companies to actually give us information of mobility from county to county? I think that would be an important element in improving this type of analysis, but that would require some sacrifice in privacy, probably. And the incubation that I didn't talk about, if someone is interested, I can get back to, it seems that we have some evidence for very long, there's some small fraction of people that have a very long incubation time. So these are the people who can remain basically infectious for a very long time. And I mean, there seems to be anecdotal evidence for that, in fact. So, I mean, this is my last slide. So the things that keep me up at night is whether this, I think like evidence for immunity is decisive at 10 sigma level in our analysis, but it may not last. And that's something that time only tells. And I give you an example of the case of New Orleans is a perfect example of what's, whether this is the case or not. I think we have to find a way of measuring social distancing more efficiently and don't just rely on the good faith of cell phone companies or Google. But I think the most important thing that keeps me up at night is how should one balance the harms due to COVID-19 against the adverse effects of lockdowns on mental health, economies, education, working parents, and et cetera. And maybe the question for you is that scientists, even astrophysicists, have a responsibility to their society. So should they roll up their sleeves and get in when millions of lives are at stake, or just stay out and leave it up to the experts to handle the situation? So thank you very much for your patience.
Okay, great. Thanks, Neil. Yeah, sure. I will applaud for everyone. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, everyone, for hanging around.
Yeah. So any more questions for Niyash? Just feel free just to jump in.
I have one about herd immunity.
Yes, go ahead.
Just a potential thing to keep us up at night, but maybe you can address it more. Do you worry that your model for herd immunity might be picking up on other things that are unique to a global pandemic? About, say, human behavior or collective behavior?
That's an excellent question. This is actually one of the things that it does keep me up at night. And I think that was actually one of the things that I did mention. This was what are the best ways to track social distancing? And I think that one of the surprising things is that the parameters we find, I mean, if this was something that depended on, I mean, like how many people show up to work and how many people show up to parks and whether that kind of varies a lot, we should have seen it when we compare different communities with each other, but it seems that these numbers appear to be very consistent across counties. So we look at big counties, the small counties, young counties, old counties, we see the same thing. So I think, in fact, the measure of social mobility we have is a reasonable measure, and I think the dependence on herd immunity is a distinctly different dependence. Now, there could be some very, very different measure that Google cannot track.
There's things like masks and social distancing within locations and so on.
Sorry, you said, that's right.
Types of interactions that are allowed.
Yeah, so my theory is that the more people who don't go to work, the more people wear masks as well. So that's kind of, I think those are correlated, but I do like a measure of time-dependent measure of what fraction of people use masks. And in fact, we do have a way of including it in our dashboard, if you look at this. But yeah, that's an excellent question. And that could be something that could be a confounding factor. But we should have seen that, we compare big, large counties with small counties possibly. But I don't think we see any obvious evidence that there is some additional factor. But there could be.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, Niyash, let me ask a question. Yes, I mean, I think to establish that what is causing the correlation between the high death rate and the decline in your gamma, in your growth rate, to establish that that is really herd immunity, surely that requires some biological tests. I'm just wondering, aren't you able to make recommendations as to what should be measured to confirm that it really is herd immunity? Because, yeah, as the previous question said, it could be a consequence of other things. People could become afraid because they see so many dying around them and then behave much more cautiously. So you've really got to make that, you've got to prove that there's a link between a biological mechanism and this outcome.
Absolutely. And again, that's one of the things that does keep me up at night. Now, Google publishes 9 different measures of social mobility. We looked at correlation with all of them, and we didn't find anything more than basically what I reported. Basically, it seems that showing up to work is the only significant correlation, and everything else doesn't seem to be significant. So yes, there could be something that doesn't show up in those measures of social mobility. Now, I think as to immunity, there are these 2 different types of tests. There are antibody tests that seem to be finding a fraction which is large, like in these places that we predict have herd immunity, of order 10%. So that could be an indicator that, I mean, maybe 10% is the right threshold. The problem is that these antibodies appear to decay over time. And then there is a theory that there's a different type of immunity for viruses. It's called T cells. And they are harder to measure as far as I understand. Maybe somebody knows more about this than I do. But I don't know there are very kind of larger scale T cell tests that are available. And that presumably that would be the thing that would be responsible for immunity. But I don't, I haven't seen any larger scale study of that. So I don't know how realistic it is. I agree absolutely with you that there must be some biological factor that, but the question is it easily testable for a large enough population?
There's multiple types of immunity in an individual. There's like a short-term immunity, and then there's a long-term memory immunity, which might not show up in the same tests.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. The question is, what is the right test to do it? And in fact, I mean, the other part of it is, what is the right population to test? And I think that's another sticky part, is that like the random people who show up to labs are not the random people who show up to supermarkets and are not necessarily your random super spreader. That's, I think those are kind of all the kind of questions that does keep me at night.
Right. I mean, I had a similar question about the super spreaders. How do you, what evidence do you have that that actually is the way in which this correlation works, you know, that it's a herd immunity of the super spreaders, which is so important?
That's right. That's a very good question. So remember I had this mysterious exponential dependence of the number of susceptibles on the number of the people who die?
Yes.
In fact, there is a way to derive that, which I hadn't, we just found it from just playing with the functions, doing fits. But then here's the derivation. So let me actually show you the derivation that we have. So imagine that, so I have just a simple differential equation on the top left. If you have a population of people who are getting infected with some rate of this beta, and I star is the rate at which, I mean, I star is the number of infected people, S is the number of susceptible people, and beta is the rate at which they are infecting, basically, susceptible. So the solution to this is, of course, is an exponential. S is decaying like e to the minus beta times integral of I star. Now, and then you could define the fraction of infected people like the second line, which is basically 1 minus the number of fraction of susceptibles is a fraction of infected. Now the thing to keep in mind now is that, imagine now there are 2 different types of populations that have different infection rates. So this, you have 2 different populations with different betas. I star is the same, so the people who are infecting are the same people, but then you have different betas. So some people basically have have very small mobility, never go to public places, and other people maybe go around all the time. So you have different betas. then you could show that this SA, the ratio of SAs at some time T to SA at time zero is given by a power law. You just change betas in that exponential. So SS are basically related by the power law. Now, what you can show is that that power law in the limit of basically this ratio becoming very big becomes an exponential, right? So that's kind of where the argument is that basically you have your general population and then you have your super spreaders. And it turns out that the way that general population reacts is like your SB, and whatever super spreaders are doing is your SA. And in the limit that you have a small fraction of people, but that have a large mobility, you could actually go through the math, which is pretty simple. You just get an exponential dependence. So basically what it tells you that, I mean, what you're having is that basically here Fi is a small, but beta A over beta B is big. So basically the people, so that means that there's some subpopulation who are infected very, very quickly. So that would be the least large beta A to beta B factor. Now, I mean, I mean, it's kind of simple math, but it may not be easiest to explain it like in a minute. But basically, this is a derivation of this exponential dependence. And it only works if you have these large fractions, this beta A over beta B is big, which is basically what we, from if you plug in the number, that means that the super spreaders are roughly between 30 to 100 times more mobile or more infectious than the rest of the population. And that basically fits the data. So that's where this exponential comes from. And if you kind of try with other possibilities, you see that it doesn't fit the data.
I just had one small point. Thank you for a great talk and great answers
to
the questions. I just have one small point. I mean, you gave two options for strategy to deal with COVID long term.
Yes.
One was to let the super spreaders stay infected, and the other was to protect the vulnerable. There is a third option. It's not happening in North America, but the third option is to eliminate the virus by testing, tracing, isolating, you know, consistently. Mm-hmm. And some countries have pursued that with great success. So I think it's really important that when you present your work, you don't take it for granted that the whole world is going to behave like the US. It's not, right?
That's right.
The third strategy is not to let COVID kill anyone.
I didn't actually say that those are the two strategies. I think those are part of one of the strategies.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
You didn't present. I'm just saying that it's really important to present another option, which is that one actually builds a public health network that monitors the health of everyone, that everybody in the population gets tested every week, for example. Mm-hmm. And by making testing more efficient and smarter, one could then detect outbreaks much more effectively and isolate the people accordingly. And this is actually happening in some countries, and it works.
But
so the trouble with the herd immunity proposal is it can sound like you're just letting government off the hook. Just let the super spreaders infect each other and we'll all be okay. So be careful, because it's a dangerous strategy. As you said, no one knows how long the immunity will last.
Right. I mean, I never actually advocated herd immunity as a strategy. All I said is that this is, you have to kind of look at, this is basically how to manage it. I think you should just look at all the data that you have available and optimize your strategy accordingly. I think that, so let me just voice my skepticism.
Yes.
So my skepticism is about the efficiency of the tests, that I think they just miss too many people, at least the tests that we've seen available. And the disease is just appears so random that, there are people who kind of have negative tests, but nevertheless, they become infectious. So that's what I'm not convinced of, and that, yes, there have been countries that have been very successful in suppressing the disease, but whether that's because of they're very effective in catching the disease, or maybe there's a different, and tracking them, or maybe there's a different underlying reason, that's not clear to me.
I see. So, I mean, the test itself for the virus, these RT-PCR tests are extremely accurate. But the problem is that people are only, you know, only have large concentrations of the virus in the right places in their bodies.
That's right.
For a short time. So you must test all the time.
I absolutely. I think if you could test a large enough fraction of population frequently enough, that could be exactly an answer. And in fact, I mean, as I said, this is kind of one of the mitigations, right? So I give just some examples, and I guess test and tracing another. So I think the important thing is that understand the cost of all of these and the viability of all of these, and then basically optimize your strategy accordingly.
Right. Agreed.
Thanks.
Okay, any further questions for Niyesh? Okay, well, if not, you know, let's stop here. Thanks again, Niyesh, you know, for a great talk. And thank you all
for
coming.
Thank you very much. Thanks everybody for showing up, and hopefully I see you around in person at some point, not too far away.
Yeah, hopefully.
Okay. See you guys, stay safe.